This is Tape 3, Side B of the Open University course, English 102, Composition in Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, course author Patty Hartford talks to Maria Campbell, the author of Half Breed. This interview was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby on February 16, 1993. Maria Campbell is speaking from her office at the University of Saskatchewan, and Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops.
You're in your office right now, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and I'm in my home office here, and I have dug out my list of questions again.
Okay.
I'm really curious about how you got started with actually putting down on paper the experiences that you had in Half-Breed. That's a really big emotional chunk of your life, and it must have been very difficult to write. I'm just wondering what prompted you to start writing.
Okay, actually, it wasn't that difficult because, first of all, I didn't start out to write a book. I'm kind of like lots of people, especially northern native people, where when I was growing up, I thought writers were all dead or they lived in England, and I never thought of myself as ever being a writer or even attempting to try. But about 1970, I was going through a really difficult time in my life, and I had nobody to talk to, basically. I was in a city where, a long way from my own people, and I had spent so many years being closed up and not opening up to anybody. And so a friend of mine told me, this was quite a number of years before, she was a Quaker lady, had told me if I needed to talk to anybody that I should write a letter and pretend that the paper was somebody that was really close to me. So that was what I did. I reached a point in my life where I knew if I fell, in other words, going back to my old life, that I was going to die, and my spirit was dying. And so I wrote a letter just for pure survival. And the letter, 2,000 pages later, Jack McClellan, quite by accident, through a mutual friend who took the paper, gave it to him, told me that I had a book and would I edit. Just to let you know how bad it was, I didn't even know what edit meant at that time. And that's how Half-Breed came to be born. And it was really, it was good for me because I pretended that the paper was my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and I wrote and wrote and wrote. And in fact, once I started, I couldn't stop, and it was like 6 months, just this, all of this really ugly stuff came out. So the first half of it was really dark, ugly stuff. It looked dreadful on paper, but I felt a whole lot better. And when I looked at it, I thought something good must have happened in my life. It couldn't have been all this bad. So then I started to write again, and I wrote down all of the memories of things that, you know, that were good memories for me. And I think the first part of my writing, the first 1,000 pages or so, was just getting rid of a lot of bile. The second half was really a healing for me.
So did you find that you eventually did do a great deal of editing?
Well, yes. The book ended up being, 160 pages, 57 or something. So from 2,000 pages. What I did once I understood what editing meant is I did the first, because there was a lot of things I didn't want anybody to see. I cut a whole lot of things out. And then once I had it down to about 300 pages and I still felt like I needed to do some more, he then assigned an editor to me and I worked with her until we had it down to 160 pages.
So you kept the rest?
Pardon?
Have you kept the rest?
No, I didn't. I had a ceremonial burning, and it was like that part of my life was finished, and, you know, there was no need for me to keep it because it was a part of my life that I was trying to get all of that ugliness out of my life because that's what was totally crippling me and paralyzing me, and so I felt that's what I should do, so it was my first traditional ceremony. I hadn't done that since I was a little girl, and I made a fire, and I put some tobacco in it, and said a prayer, and thanked the thank the grandmothers for helping me through this time, and I burned it. So that's the story of how Half-Breed happened.
And since then, obviously, you've gone on to write more. Do you still write about things personal to you, or have you sort of shifted?
Well, I think that, I can't imagine any writer not writing from someplace inside, even if the story takes a whole different turn. I know certainly for myself, I've done a lot of writing. I have quite a number of short stories, fiction, but they come from, from experiences that I've had, or whatever, something that I saw that really touched me, mm-hmm. or people that I've met. I mean, writers always use everything around them, and the stories have never been published yet, simply because I've never stopped long enough to do a whole lot of editing with them, which is something that I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. But what did happen to me is I started to I had a lot of difficulty in the beginning to write in English. Because writing an autobiography is one thing, it's a whole other thing when you try writing fiction or poetry, which is what I do as well, mm-hmm. is that I went back to my elders at that point and I started to sort of relearn, just for my own healing, the old way. And in doing that, I happened to mention to one of my teachers that I was having so much difficulty expressing myself in English. And so through that conversation and a whole lot of other things, I started to study oral tradition and to relearn. Although I was fluent in my language, I started to relearn my own language and to look at the meaning of words and sort of the baggage that each word has, because each word has a whole lot of relatives mm-hmm. that belong with it, instead of just looking at a literal translation. Mm-hmm. And when I started to do that, I found that I no longer was afraid or no longer had a block about writing in English. I was able to do it. And I think what happened is that as a result of relearning my language, I was centering myself and making myself strong enough so that the English language didn't manipulate me anymore, and I was able to use it as a tool in order to express myself. And in the book of Jessica, which is started out as a play called Jessica, that came from some of my experiences, which later resulted in the book of Jessica, which was conversations between myself and the actress who performed that lead role first time. And that was kind of exploring my own spiritual journey and wanting to share that with other young women that I knew were expressing difficulty.
Do you focus a lot on women's issues and the things that affect Native women?
I don't do it on purpose, the thing I find is that in working with oral tradition, which is my foundation, in my fiction, my poetry, and in any of the history things that I'm working on, is that because the old stories of women, the old women, nobody has ever looked at Aboriginal women. They've always been sort of, the history books said they were drudges or whatever, and European, historians, anthropologists are trained in the European way of thinking that women's stuff is not important, and certainly not Native women's stuff. So I found a whole wealth of stories that really helped me to find who I was. But in looking at those stories, and also in looking at my own language, and trying to decode or whatever you want to call it, I started to find that a lot of the things that are happening in community, the healing tools for those things are in those stories. And so my writing is very grandmother based. I call it grandmother based. But I don't think in terms of, that I'm writing for men or for women. I'm writing for the community. Mm-hmm. And certainly my writing, I see myself as a keeper of oral stories. That's what the elders have trained me as. And in our culture, grandmother owns half the circle, and we can't have a healthy circle unless her circle, her side, is healthy as well. And in her being healthy, it means that grandfather's side of the circle will be healthy as well. And as a result of that, I've really explored the whole area of traditional oral tradition, you know, the way the old stories were that haven't been changed, versus the oral tradition of colonized peoples. And I've found so much of what's happening to us in our country among our own people is the whole attitude of men toward, you know, Aboriginal men toward women, and just Canadian, you know, system and society toward women in general, which, you know, is also the way that Aboriginal men look at women, and through no fault of their own, you know, they're very much, their thinking is very much influenced by the society around them, and the society around us, you know, are certainly colonized in their thinking. I don't know if this is making much sense.
It is, and I was just thinking that it comes through very well in Half-Breed, some of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is the most important thing for Native people to write about? Would it be the oral tradition to preserve that?
No, I don't believe that there's any... You know, I think that whatever we write about is important. However, I think it is important for people like myself who speak the language and whom the elders, you know, decide that they're going to train, because not all of us, I mean, it's really tedious work learning. You know, you literally become a servant of the old people. But I think that it's important for people like myself to really work hard in oral tradition and to understand it, because that's the foundation of our literature. It's the foundation of everything in our community. You know, within the stories are the laws of our community. There are the values, the traditions. If we're talking about self-government, self-determination, certainly we'll find all of those things in the stories. You know, one of my elders told me, it doesn't matter who it is in the community a long time ago, they always had to come to the storyteller, because in there would be what they would need. And I think in studying oral tradition, for those people who choose to do that, in studying oral tradition and relearning our language from an Aboriginal perspective is really important, because otherwise it's going to die. You know, the tradition will be lost, and our literature won't have that as a foundation. And I think it's important. When I look at the literature of other Aboriginal peoples, because there's been a lot of it since Half-Breed has come out, and especially in the last few years, even those Aboriginal writers who don't speak the language and also didn't grow up in a, you know, on the land like I did, There's memories of that in their work. You'll find, if you know oral tradition, you'll find that in their work, and so that it's important, I think, for people like myself to be able to talk about that because I teach oral tradition here, to be able to show how that's happening. Because what it does is it tells our young people that even if you've lost your language, the memory is still there. And that there's no such thing as that we can become European or whatever, because as writers, we work, it's like peeling an onion, we work, even when we're not aware of it, we're working toward the essence, peeling layers back, and when we reach the essence, our memory does a lot for us, and we don't even know that it's doing it.
That's a great analogy. I think I already have a feeling for the answer to this question, but what is your reaction to non-Native writers writing fiction about Native people?
Well, I don't like to tell people what they should write and what they shouldn't write. However, one of the things that I first of all, I'm an advocate of the whole appropriation question that's been happening. I've worked really hard on that. I think that it's respect, you know, that if people respect each other and if there's respect for each other, then there's no discrimination or racism, because anything can happen out of respect. And I think if non-Native writers respect Aboriginal people, if they think that our stuff is good enough, then if they respect it, they'll leave it alone, because that's the inheritance of our children, and it should be left alone. It should be looked after and handled and worked with only by our own people. And that's something that I really believe. I think that I would never take on myself to go and bother the inheritance of Chinese children or Irish children or whatever to try and interpret their community back to them. I think that there are many, many writers in Canada that can do this, you know, and more that's being possible because Canada Council and these other institutions who work with writers or with artists in the community are starting to recognize what we've been saying for a long time, that we don't have very much left in, you know, as Aboriginal people in our country. Our land has been, you know, taken, everything else, and that is that, and voice and the cultural things are all we have left to pass on to our children, and they won't get lost, you know, because which is the argument that they use all the time, is that, well, it's going to be lost if we don't write it. We're saying that it won't ever be lost, that ours is going to be intact long after everybody else has forgot what their roots are. And it's important for them to not disturb that, because, well, like I say, that belongs to my grandchildren. And look at it this way. If somebody invites you into their home, you don't walk away with their family treasures. And our culture and our stories and our traditions and ceremonies are the treasures of our family. That's what we pass down.
I don't know that anyone could say it better. Who are your own favorite writers? Who do you like to read?
My favorite writers? Well, goodness, I'm always I'm a real reader. I read all sorts of things. I guess one of my a new poet whose work that I really admire is Beth Cuthan. She's a poet from Saskatchewan, and I find her work really exciting because she's a contemporary poet. She's looking at the Aboriginal community, and she's speaking very honestly, you know, and looking at it honestly and mirroring it back. I can't think of right offhand. I mean, there's so many writers whose work that I really admire. I've done a lot of reading of Irish literature. And
why Irish?
Because they're a colonized people, and they have a long history of resistance, and very similar kinds of things happen to them throughout their history as ours. I can really identify with where they're coming from in their writing. Their work makes sense to me. You know, I can read it, and I can. There's an essence in it that's really powerful. And they're not afraid to have good critical kinds of thinking in their work. And John Steinbeck was somebody that influenced me a lot when I was younger, and I still love his work. I like the work of Margaret Lawrence. I can't think
of variety
of names offhand.
What do you think is your best work?
What do I think is my best work? The work, I think that, you know, that all of my work has been the best that I could give it. But I think the one that I quite treasure the most is Little Badger and the Fire Spirit. It was my first time working with with something that the elders gave me, the story that was lost. You know, it was one of the pieces that nobody knew the complete story, and I talked to a group of elders, and each one of them remembered different pieces, and so in a way it was fiction. I took the essence of what was there and looked at the structure of our oral tradition and used that in the writing. And also because when I finished writing it, I learned something, and I didn't do that intentionally. The whole story of the little blind boy, you know, going into the mountain to get fire for his people, and then coming back out, and being able to see, and seeing the world for the first time was like something else. I was writing something else about myself, and I maybe didn't realize it, but it opened a new door for me when I finished that. And the story has been out of print for quite a number of years, and I'm wanting to reprint it again, you know, republish it again. But and that one was from my first grandchild as well. The idea came from him. Grandma, where did we get fire?
So you are carrying on the oral as well as the written tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously have critics within your family, like grandchildren and
uh-huh.
others. How do you respond to things that people say about your work, both people close to you and those who would be critiquing your work for
I've listened to some people who've given papers on my work, and sometimes I think, well, where on earth did they get that from? Because it's certainly not what I was saying or doing, but people read things into your work that you didn't, you know, and sometimes I think, wow, you know, is that what I was saying? But I'm very fortunate as far as my own community, and I say this, you know, with incredible gratitude. I've never had anybody in my community criticize me. I've never had anybody tell me it was, you know, to sit down, and I've had, you know, sometimes people are uptight with me, but it's because of my political activity more than anything else. But I've never had anybody do anything except give me an incredible amount of encouragement and support. And when I think of outside of my own community, I think the only real criticism I ever got was from the Department of Indian Affairs, who said that I had a tendency to write Harlequin romances. But I've, you know, and as far as criticism, in, you know, constructive criticism, you take a lot of criticism when you're working with editors, but it's not criticism in a negative sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, something is not clear or whatever. But I think that I've been really fortunate in that I haven't had a lot of the kinds of experiences that other writers have had. And sometimes I think it's because I work... You know, I don't think of myself as a writer. I never have. I'm a community worker, a storyteller, and writing is one of the tools that I work to make change. And I have long discussions with my own teachers before I publish something. You know, I write it, and then I discuss it with them. And I don't know, I think the grandmothers have taken very good care of me. I always say that the spirits of my grandmothers must have wanted to write, because it certainly isn't because I've had any. And sometimes that sounds kind of New Agey, and I don't want that to happen, but certainly in our tradition, those gifts come from what we call the grandmothers and grandfathers, and I think that I was really blessed.
I heard an interesting discussion recently in which someone was talking about how New Age is just old age revisited and stated a little differently.
Yeah, that's probably true, although some of it is. You know, I think that people are in real need of some kind of security and, you know, spiritually. And I think that a lot of people exploit that. And some of it is quite scary, because any time that anybody exploits something, it is scary. But I think that there's some genuinely good stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too bad, because when we're looking for something, and I know I spent many years trying to find a place that wasn't quicksand under my feet, and you run into all kinds of what would you call them? The old snake oil salesman.
Right. Charlatan.
Yeah. I think that we have to be really careful when we look at something and think, does this feel good inside? And use all the senses that we've been given to look at it.
Well, why don't we have you read a passage from Half Breed?
Okay.
Any part you choose.
Yeah. Okay, should I just start?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I was born during a spring blizzard in April of 1940. Granny Campbell, who had come to help my mom, made Dad stay outside the tent, and he chopped wood until his arms ached. At last I arrived, a daughter, much to Dad's disappointment. However, this didn't dampen his desire to raise the best trapper and hunter in Saskatchewan. As far back as I can remember, Dad taught me to set traps, shoot a rifle, and fight like a boy. Mum did her best to turn me into a lady, showing me how to cook, sew, and knit, while Cheechum, my best friend and confidant, tried to teach me all she knew about living. I should tell you about our home before I go any further. We lived in a large two-room, hewed log house that stood out from the others because it was too big to be called a shack. One room was used for sleeping, and all of us children shared it with our parents. There were three big beds made from poles with rawhide interlacing. The mattresses were canvas bags filled with fresh hay twice a year. Over my parents' bed was a hammock where you could always find a baby. An airtight heater warmed the room in winter. Our clothes hung from pegs or were folded and put on a row of shelves. There were braided rugs on the floor, and in one corner, a special sleeping rug where Cheechum slept when she stayed with us. She refused to sleep on a bed or eat off a table. I loved that corner of the house and would find any excuse possible to sleep with her. There was a special smell that comforted me when I was hurt or afraid. Also, it was a great place to find all sorts of wonderful things that Cheechum had. Little pouches, boxes, cloth tied up containing pieces of bright cloth, beads, leather, jewelry, roots, herbs, candy, and whatever else a little girl's heart could desire. The kitchen and living room were combined into one of the most beautiful rooms I have ever known. Our kitchen had a huge black wood stove for cooking and for heating the house. On the wall hung pots and pans and various roots and herbs used for cooking and making medicine. There was a large table, two chairs, and two benches made from wide planks, which were scrubbed with homemade lye soap after each meal. On one wall were shelves for our good dishes and a cupboard for storing everyday tin plates, cups, and food. The living room area had a homemade Chesterfield and chair of carved wood and woven rawhide, a couple of rocking chairs painted red, and an old steamer trunk by the east window. The floor was made of wide planks, which were scoured to an even whiteness all over. We made braided rugs during the winter months from our old rags, although it often took us a year to gather enough for even a small rug. There were open beams on the ceiling, and under these ran four long poles the length of the house. The poles served as racks where furs were hung to dry in winter. On a cold winter night, the smell of moose meat simmering on the stove blended with the wild smell of the drying skins of mink, weasels, and squirrels, and the spicy herbs and roots hanging from the walls. Daddy would be busy in the corner brushing fur until it shone and glistened, while Mum bustled around the wood stove. My Cheechum would be on the floor smoking her clay pipe, and the small ones would roll and fight around her like puppies. I can see it all so vividly, it seems only yesterday. Okay?
Thank you. I'm glad you chose that passage. It was one that I chose to quote from in our part of our discussion of the story, because the nostalgia of it really was striking. It was also a very beautiful passage, and certainly not... what we would traditionally call a beautiful house, and yet it is. It's mm-hmm. a beautiful home, and that comes through very clearly.
It's what everybody called a half-breed shack.
It's interesting. At the end of the book, you talk about going back and how things were different than mm-hmm. they had been. Do you think that that was because times had changed and the community had changed, or do you think that it was just as much that you had changed and you had grown up and were seeing the community through different eyes?
Oh, no, times had changed. And they changed dramatically because when I went back, there had been homes that had been torn down and people relocated. But also there was the whole scoops of the 50s where, you know, where government came in and took all the children away from the parents. In the community where I grew up, there was only two families that were left intact. The rest of the children were put into foster homes, some of them right outside of the country. So people were completely and totally devastated by what had happened. And one of the things that when I was writing Half Breed, I didn't know what had happened to everybody. And the whole thing of children being gone from the community, I hadn't dealt with that very well yet because I was still struggling with what had happened to my own family. And things had changed dramatically in just a matter of a few short years for the people.
What was the response of people in your community to the story itself?
The response from the community?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the community wasn't there anymore.
Right, I was just going to say that. Whoever was left from your family.
But the people, the people were scattered, but we still know where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And the response was good. I mean, I've never had anybody from my own community criticize me. And if they have, it hasn't been to me, and I haven't heard about it. However, the white community was very angry, and they still are. They said that I lied, that things weren't that bad, and some of them confronted me. In fact, one of them was going to sue me, and I never did use any of their real names. But they didn't know what it was like. They didn't live in that community. I mean, to this day, they won't admit that these scoops were made where children were taken away just to get the people off their land and relocated. They're ignorant, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. They lived beside people and dealt with them every day of their lives and knew nothing about them, knew nothing at all about the people, and still don't. They were blinders. They're just very narrow people. They were upset because they said that it made them look bad. And that certainly wasn't the intention when I was writing. I wasn't thinking of who I was trying to make look bad. I was just writing what I remembered. But my own community, as I said, has never... I was at a conference, in fact, in I believe it was about 1979, here in Saskatchewan, where I was attacked at a large gathering of Aboriginal people by a non-Native woman. Who came from my area, and I can't remember what she said, but it was like within a matter of minutes there were Native people lined up at the microphones, and the chairman had to stop it because it was all people saying that I had told their story as well.
Well, the title of the book, Half-Breed, usually carries all sorts of negative connotations. Why did you choose this one word for your title?
Well, people ask me that a lot. The original title I had was My Cheechum's Children, and I was going through this title. I just couldn't come up with one, and Jack McClellan wasn't too happy about My Cheechum's Children because he said people wouldn't understand that. And I had an old friend. He was an old man in his 80s who spent a lot of time visiting me and was my real support system of mine. And he came over one day, and I told him, I said, I can't come up with a title. And he always called me Half-Breed. You know, he'd phone me, or whenever he'd see me, he'd always call me Half-Breed. He'd say, well, Half-Breed, how are you doing? And so he told me, he said, why don't you call it Half-Breed? And he said, that'll make people buy it.
Certainly makes people open up their eyes and look, doesn't it?
And he was right, you know, I mean, it was...
it certainly shows the book itself certainly shows the attitudes of others towards half-breeds. And,
yeah.
And so he probably gave you a very wise suggestion there.
And it was always, you know, and people called us that in a negative sense. You know, they always said breeds. But we also called ourselves half-breed simply because, you know, the English word that was being used was Métis, and that's, you know, that's not a word. I mean, I can remember coming home telling my grandmother we were Métis, and she threatened to give me a licking if I ever used that word again. Because our real name is Michifa, which is nothing near Métis at all.
Mm.
But most people just said breeds in that way. That included the Irish, English, Scottish half-breed people as well.
In talking to you now, it seems as though you identify largely with the native part of your heritage. What part does your European background play in your life at this point?
I've never really, you know, when I think European, although I have, you know, I have some Scottish and I have some French and some Irish in my background, it's a long way off, and I've, you know, other than looking at the work of Irish people, I've never really thought a lot about it because I don't identify with European culture at all in any way, shape, or form. And I grew up, as I say, on the land. My family for generations back lived off the land, and although we were Métis, and there was a distinct line between us and Indian people, there wasn't a line between us and non-treaty people, with non-status people. My first language is Cree, and I speak, as I say, I speak Cree fluently. My great-grandmothers were non-Christian. They practiced the old way. And so that was a solid part of my life, as well as you know, being Catholic. My mother was Catholic and attending all of those things, and I didn't have any kinds of problems with any of that until I started school. I was quite comfortable and never thought of myself as living in a dual culture or anything else. We lived off the land, and we lived as Indian people did in my great-grandmother's time. But I don't think very much about, you know, am I Indian or am I half-breed. I'm moved very comfortably between the two communities, and you know, it's a government. It's a government. They're all government definitions, and certainly with Métis people, we have a language. You know, I speak Cree and I speak Michif as well, which is the language of Métis people.
Mm-hmm.
But my culture is the land. You know, I identify with the land, and that was how I grew up, you know, picking berries, gathering, helping my grandmothers with medicine and things. And I didn't live on a reserve, but I lived in the wilderness in an isolated community.
I was just thinking that your book has probably helped if there was a gap, as you seem to indicate in the early part of the book, between the Native people and the Métis people. Your book seems to narrow that to a great degree.
Yeah, I find that both Indian and Métis people have identified with the book and have, you know, I think when those kinds of things happen, it happens at a political level,
mm-hmm.
but not at a community level where, I mean, the kind of life that I lived was lived by all sorts of people as far as living off the land and the way that, you know, we always had some power that was, you know, running our lives for us.
So let's turn to Maria Campbell today. If you, we've talked a lot about your past, and I feel as though I know, and many of the students who will read your book know quite a bit about your earlier life. What's happened to you since the writing of Half Breed?
Well, I've published several books. I've published three children's books, and I work a lot with children. My first work has always been with children and with women. I do a lot of community work. So I've published three children's books. I've published co-published the book of Jessica. I've written several plays and I've directed plays. I'm also a filmmaker. I work with film and video. I did, produced and directed my first one-hour drama last year. Up until then, I'd worked in documentary. And I'm working on another documentary right now. I think I've shot about 10 documentaries. I've been a producer and director of a television series for 3 years. And I do a lot of teaching. And this is my first year teaching full-time. And I'm teaching oral tradition and native literature as well as creative writing.
And this is at the University of Saskatchewan?
Yeah.
I conduct
a lot of workshops in creative writing, but working with traditional things. I have 5 grandchildren. The oldest one is 19. My kids are all grown up. They've all graduated from university, and my brothers and sisters are all healthy, and they're teaching school. A couple of them are into making films. And I have a brother that's a painter. People always want to know about my brothers and sisters. They're all well, and my dad is doing very well, and he's retired from the trap line, and he's now in his late 70s.
Do you see your family often?
Oh, yeah, we're very close, and we see each other often.
It seems like such a big jump from the early experiences, particularly, I suppose, those once you left Saskatchewan, to the life that you're living now.
It is a big jump. It's not just a big jump for me. It's a big jump for my whole family, my brothers and sisters, because once I was able to get myself together one by one, we found each other, and our lives changed. We were able to help each other with that. And I really, really owe a lot, I feel, to our father, to my dad, because with all of the stuff he had against him, he was able to, in the end, when we got back together, was able to pull our family together again, and because of him, we were able to. I didn't go back to school or anything, but my brothers and sisters, as adults, went to university and pursued different careers. But my father has been, we're just a really lucky family, I think. We've had some pretty horrific things happen to us, and I have too. My life hasn't, though my writing and my publishing and my work has done well, my personal life hasn't always been the greatest. It's up and down, and we've had some pretty traumatic times, but it's been nothing that I haven't been able to handle. But, my dad has been really instrumental in that.
Mm-hmm. Just as a closing note here, can you offer any advice to a student in this course who is about to read Half-Breed?
No, I guess except to read it with an open mind and to remember that things haven't changed a whole lot as far as conditions in the community and the whole question of racism. All those things are even worse than they were when I was growing up. And to not close your mind and think this is a bitter kind of story, because it's not a bitter story. It's a story about healing. And other than that, I don't know what to say. I just hope that it helps myself and the reader to be able to build a better community for our babies, which is what it's all about.
Thank you, Maria. I really appreciate it.